Hello, everyone, and welcome to McGill Care's webcast series, Supporting Family and Informal Caregivers. I'm Claire Webster, a former caregiver, certified dementia care consultant, and founder of McGill University's Dementia Education Program. I work with a dynamic team of leading healthcare professionals to oversee the program, who include Dr. José Moret from the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Dr. Serge Gauthier, Professor Emeritus, formerly of the McGill University Research Center for Studies in Aging. McGill Cares is supported by the Amelia Saputo Community Outreach for Dementia Care. Before we begin today's webcast, I just wanted to let everybody know that the McGill Dementia Education Program offers a very comprehensive range of free resources to educate and support persons living with dementia, family and informal caregivers, healthcare professionals, medical students, and the public at large. One of our most important resources is our Dementia Companion Guide, which can be downloaded for free. It's now available in 8 different languages, with many more languages to come. Printed copies can be obtained on Amazon for a cost of $20 per book, and it really goes to support our program. So please have a look. You can download this for free, a very, very important resource that is available to you. So today we will be discussing authentic healing in patients with advanced dementia. My guest is Dr. Justin Sanders, who is the Cappy and Eric Flanders Chair of Palliative Care, Director of the Division of Palliative Care, and Associate Professor in the Department of Family Medicine at McGill University. He is an Associate Faculty Member at Ariadne Labs, a Health Systems Innovation Center at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. As a clinician investigator and physician leader, Dr. Sanders' work focuses on the promotion of authentic healing relationships in serious illness through social science-informed and equity-focused communication and implementation research. Welcome to McGill Cares, Dr. Sanders.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, before we begin and getting into the whole topic of authentic healing, you know, can you tell me why you chose to become a specialist in palliative care?
Sure. You know, I think in many ways, for many of us, it feels like the field chose us. I will say that for myself, I think this work or the origin of this work for me began with at the bedside of my best friend who died of ovarian cancer at the age of 21. And I think being there as a young person, experiencing what for many would be, well, in many ways was a tragic event, but also gave me the opportunity to see that I could sit in this space with a person at this time of life, and that there could be some things that felt what I would later describe as healing in some way. That that the release of relief from suffering that my friend experienced in the last days and hours of her life was in many ways a healing event, and I continue to draw inspiration from that in my own work.
It's incredible how some tragic or sad or challenging life journeys can really bring us to our next step. It really is incredible. You know, I look at myself and the work that I'm doing, and a very difficult time in my life can make you all of a sudden realize what your life's purpose is.
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, in a profession like yours, it must take a tremendous amount of emotional strength, because, you know, you're accompanying people to the end of their life consistently. And then you're also having to be there to support and witness the grief of families. Like, what type of strength does that take in a career like yours?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, people often say to me that this, say things to me like, this work must be so depressing and it must be so hard, but I draw such meaning from this work, and it is emotionally salient, but I think that that's what gives it its depth. And for me, it's rewards in this work. I find that we can't avoid the emotion of these moments, but we can draw something from them as well. And I think the ability to engage with families emotionally around these very difficult times in their lives, and very important times in their lives, is is a tremendous privilege. So I don't feel that my work is hard at all. And really, I feel that I gain so much from it in working with people. It's a tremendous privilege to be able to work with people, you know, at this time, from, you know, people from all walks of life. I think that's one of the greatest gifts of being a clinician.
So I'm extremely interested in education, especially at the medical school level. And do all medical students and nurses receive training in palliative care, including having to have those difficult conversations about discussing a terminal illness or how much time a person has left, like those difficult conversations?
I would say that the training in having difficult conversations is insufficient globally in medical education. It's true at the undergraduate level, it's true at the postgraduate level, and I think that there are many physicians and other clinicians entering the workforce who feel ill-prepared and unconfident in having the kinds of discussions that for patients and families make an enormous difference in their patient, in their experience of their illness. I know that, you know, we're lucky at McGill, building on the foundation of the palliative care program that was started here in the 1970s, that we have a lot of access to medical students. And I would say that there remain opportunities to improve their education around communication. It's interesting to me that these skills globally are often referred to as soft skills. Mm-hmm. And yet they remain the hardest skills to master in our clinical lives and work. So I think it's, I think shifting the way that we think about these skills is somehow these quote unquote non-technical skills is a really important opportunity in medical education to help people understand just how important they are. Because, I often think that the best training I had as a physician was working as a waiter, you know, and if you go to a restaurant and you have, you know, the food doesn't come out on time, or there's problems with your order. If you have a skilled waiter who can help manage your expectations and help, you know, and apologize and somehow make the experience positive, you're willing to go back to that person. And it's not different, in fact, in medicine, because errors happen all the time, because this is a human endeavor. And yet our ability to communicate with people to help them manage the uncertainty that comes with it, particularly with the diagnosis of a serious illness, but also manage expectations, help them come through the experience in some way feeling whole, is incredibly powerful. And again, one of the hardest skills to master in healthcare.
Can you share with us your role as the director of the Division of Palliative Care and the Kathy and Eric M. Flanders Chair of Palliative Care at McGill? So what do you do?
Sure. Well, that's, you know, it's a good question, because I feel like I'm building the airplane while flying it a little bit. You know, I see as my mandate to really grow the academic program that I think was previously strong 20 years ago at within Palliative Care McGill. And really, you know, at a high level, what I hope to do is build an identity for palliative care at McGill that extends beyond what it's sort of always been, which is this sort of historical place that, you know, where this idea, where palliative care kind of took root, you know, literally in terms of its name, when as Balfour Mount gave it that name. I'd like for us to have a contemporary identity and contemporary contributions to the care of patients with serious illness, not just here in Montreal, but around the world. And I think that we have the tremendous capacity to do that. And, you know, building the organization to make that possible is sort of what I hope to do. It does include things like the educational programming at McGill. And so for me, I share your passion and interest for education. I think it's incredibly important in how we build the structures at the undergraduate, postgraduate, and professional level to support clinicians in providing the best care for people with serious illness is incredibly important.
So can you maybe define palliative care? Because, you know, when I think of palliative care, I think of somebody who's really reached that final month, for example, of a terminal illness. They're in the hospital, you know, the families around them. Like, what is palliative care? Like, when can palliative care begin, for example, and what does it look like?
So palliative care is specialized medical care interprofessional in nature, that intends to improve quality of life and well-being for patients affected by serious illness and their loved ones. Now, the problem that we have now, I think, in some places, is that there's a tightly held association between palliative care and end-of-life care. The problem with that is the definitional question related to the end of life. Like, what is the end of life? You mentioned, for example, the last month. Some people would say it's the last 2 days, it's the last 2 weeks, it's the last year. And I think that what this lack of clarity around the definition of end of life leaves families in a position where they're kind of at the mercy of the clinician in front of them and what their view is of the quote unquote end of life. That leaves them really unable to benefit from all of what we know palliative care can provide to people in the setting of serious illness. So palliative care, you know, it used to be conceived that, you know, you had a person who was diagnosed with a serious illness like advanced cancer, end-stage organ disease, neurologic disease like dementia would undergo curative or disease modifying therapy until it stopped. And then the doctor would say, I'm sorry, there's nothing more that we can do for you. And then I'd like you to see my palliative care colleagues who will take care of you until the end of their life. And what we know about that model and its insufficiency is that people don't benefit from palliative care until it's too late. Mm-hmm. And so what we've learned over time, and really this is a model that's now 15 plus years old, is that palliative care should be integrated at the time of diagnosis of a serious illness. And that over time, the role of palliative care becomes more and more prominent in the care of that patient and their family's lives. And we have seen over time that there's an abundance of evidence that suggests in various illnesses that patients have better quality of life. Family members have better outcomes in terms of their bereavement and well-being during that patient's life, and that in some cases patients actually, well, let me put it this way: patients don't die sooner when they get palliative care in that way. In some cases, they live longer. I think that makes sense because our attention to people's quality of life allows them to function better, and function is one of the greatest predictors of how long people live. And so, you know, it's a long answer to your question, but yeah. I think palliative care is, it should be introduced and integrated into the care of people at a much earlier stage of serious illness.
So then explain, what are the components about the palliative care that would provide a better quality of life? Like, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean? Medication? Does it mean nutrition? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. So there was a very famous study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2010 by Jennifer Temel at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, where they looked at the early integration of palliative care to patients with advanced lung cancer. And while they found that patients had better mental health outcomes, that they had better quality of life, and that they, in some cases, lived longer, or on average, lived longer, what was really helpful was a follow-up study that looked at what exactly happened in those palliative care encounters. What they found was that much of what happens is related to symptom management. So for example, when people have pain or difficulty breathing, nausea, either due to the disease itself or to the treatments for the disease, that they were able to manage those symptoms in ways that improved quality of life. But more importantly was the work that went into preparation for what was to come, to supporting coping through a multidisciplinary approach that includes psychosocial oncology, for example, in the case of cancer care, social work, and attention to people's overall well-being. Palliative care was conceived on one of the fundamental ideas at the core of palliative care is this idea of total pain, which is the idea that people with serious illness experience multiple threats to their well-being and experience suffering in ways that is multidimensional, psychosocial, psychological, spiritual, existential. And palliative care's attention to those through high quality communication, through the elicitation of people's goals and values, through understanding of their fears and worries is a huge part of what we do for patients and their families.
So what would this look like for somebody with advanced dementia? Because somebody, and I have experienced this, I accompanied my mom to the end, And, you know, when you're trying to really support and take care of a person that can no longer communicate with you, they can't verbally tell you how they're feeling. They can't. So what would palliative care look like for somebody with advanced dementia?
You know, I'd say this is a really important question. One that has personal resonance for me because my grandmother died of Alzheimer's dementia a number of years ago, living in a home. So I think it's a good question that I think our field is still trying to define. One of the issues, of course, is that if access to our services is predicated on the idea that someone has a serious illness, and some people, you know, in the while there is a consensus definition of serious illness that relates to people's suffering and their burden on caregivers, for instance. Some people have found that it's useful to have another way of thinking about it, which is like, is this person at high risk of dying in the near future, for example, in the next year? And the issue with dementia and frailty, for example, with which it's often associated, is that people can experience this over the course of many, many years. Mm-hmm. And so trying to decide when it's appropriate to engage someone in specialist palliative care is a really tricky issue, because sometimes people can live, while there are the many frustrations for the individual and many burdens to their caregivers, people with dementia themselves can often be relatively healthy in their body while sort of undergoing this neurologic process. Mm-hmm. I think what we need to understand better is about how we integrate the principles of palliative care earlier, for example, around the time of diagnosis of a dementia, that help people sort of start to think earlier on, before they lose capacity, about the things that matter most to them, about what they would about what they would want if time became short, if something came up that made them critically ill. What are the things they're most worried about? Not because we can always fix those things, but because talking about our worries is actually therapeutic for patients and for caregivers. And so I think finding a way to integrate the principles of palliative care, either through the community of geriatricians and family doctors that care for people with dementia, and creating sort of pathways so that if there arises a need for specialist palliative care, if there are situations that are particularly difficult that require our communication expertise, that we find ways of triaging to make sure that those people and their families get access to the best of what we have to provide is probably the way forward.
I think also it has to do with advocating for their safety and their best well-being possible, because late stage dementia could last couple of years, right? And I'm unlike your grandmother, my mother was in a long-term care facility, and my role really became to advocate, become her voice, and ensure that the food she was eating, that she wouldn't choke on the food that she was eating, to make sure that she was brought for fresh air outdoors, that she was clean. That she was healthy, but I remember, because of the lack of communication, I had to constantly pay attention to her visual cues. I knew when she was uncomfortable by the expression in her eyes or the expression in her face. And it's very, very, like I said before, as compared to somebody who doesn't have dementia, when they can verbally talk to you, somebody with dementia can. And I became kind of like an expert in visual cues. The last 2 years of her life, and when things weren't going right, almost like you have to become a detective and figure out what's going on, right? Like, what is happening to this person as a whole?
Well, and I'd say, the innovations in dementia care in the last 10, 15 years have been extraordinary in terms of how people have conceptualized the care of people with dementia. For example, setting up homes in ways that allow for people to wander, in ways that aren't distressing to them, in ways that create environments that that trigger memories, positive memories, or create the opportunity for that through music or other things, mm-hmm. in ways that aren't about disagreeing with someone who has dementia when they make statements that don't make sense, but rather, you know, allowing that to just exist in ways that don't cause distress to us. I mean, those are extraordinary things that we have learned over the years and that have started to go into practice. I think what palliative care might be able to add is this sort of explicit focus on quality of life and dignity. Because if we're not oriented toward that, you know, then we're just sort of oriented towards only combating the disease, which is really important, but we can't give up on one for the sake of the other. And I think that our explicit focus on the dignity of patients and families has a real place in the care of all people affected by life-limiting illness, including dementia.
So talk to me about authentic healing. What is authentic healing?
Yeah. So when I think about authentic healing relationships, it's interesting because I think about healing relationships and I think about authenticity. And I think that we have all experienced in our, you know, travels in healthcare, meeting a clinician with whom you have a conversation that doesn't feel authentic. You know, that feels like it feels like you're working with someone who has a persona of a doctor or a nurse or whatever. I think doctors are the most likely to sort of, you know, inhabit these sort of inauthentic spaces in healthcare. And on the other hand, we've all had experiences where you meet a clinician with whom you feel an authentic connection because they are vulnerable in small ways, or they allow themselves to be known. They endeavor to know you in some way. And I think that one of the, you know, if one of the insights in palliative care was this idea of total pain and the multidimensional nature of suffering, the other was one that was articulated by my predecessor, Balfour Mount, and his colleagues in thinking about healing, the importance of healing, and the idea that growth and and an experience of integrity, through the course of serious illness and up until the end of life, is possible. Which in a healthcare milieu in which disease is considered sort of fundamentally a breakdown of the body, you know, or of the neuro, you know, of our physiology, the idea that somehow something positive can come of that is a really radical idea. So I think, and what they said about healing was that it is a relational construct, that's something that takes place in the context of relationships. And when you ask people what's important to them, you know, as they approach the end of their life, almost everybody says, you know, it almost always has to do with relationships. Mm-hmm. With their children, with their parents, with their spouses, with their friends, and what I think clinicians have too often failed to realize is that their own relationships with their patients really matter to patients and their caregivers. I have found that they matter to me a lot, and I feel that it allows me to engage people in a way that feels authentic to who I am, and that I think is felt by patients and their family members. So what I'm trying to, when I talk about authentic healing relationships, I'm talking about the authenticity is about what we as clinicians bring to these encounters in ways that are felt as authentic, as authentically caring, and that promote this experience of healing in the setting of serious illness.
Do you think, though, that for those clinicians that are not as authentic, could it just be their way of setting boundaries for themselves so that they don't get emotionally attached to their patients? I mean, is that a possibility?
Well, it is certainly a trope in medicine and medical education that that becoming too emotionally involved is a threat to one's objectivity. I will tell you that for myself, I have never believed it and never found that to be true. I think that my ability to authentically engage with someone as a human is what makes me good, not only makes my work sustainable, but I think it makes me a better clinician. I think it's true that we have to have a certain degree of self-awareness about the ways in which some families more than others engage us in ways that are more emotional and to whom we feel more connected. But that's not a failure it's not a failure of our skills as a clinician to feel connected to a patient. In fact, it makes us better at our work. And I think this is true. This has been true. Our ability to see people as humans, which is, you know, is sort of at the heart of authenticity. I think authentic relationships, you know, is something that all of the great sort of historical teachers in medicine, from William Osler to Francis Weld Peabody and others, have talked about. So, you know, I think it's it's an unfortunate myth, I think, in healthcare that somehow, you know, engaging with families emotionally makes you a less skilled clinician, or somehow is going to lead to, you know, disproportionate burden in your clinical life. I think it's quite the opposite. In fact, when we try to stifle our ability to connect with people, I think it makes our work much less sustainable, and I think is in fact contributing greatly to the burnout that is endemic in medical care today.
So a big gap that I feel that exists in the healthcare system, it's the support for family members or friends once the person passes away. So for example, I accompanied both my parents until the end. I was alone in the hospital with my father, who passed away from congestive heart failure. I was with my mother alone the last, you know, 2 days of once she had passed away, and I witnessed the passing of both my parents. And, you know, a lot of efforts made in palliative care, but then here I am, I've just gone through this trauma of having to say goodbye to both of my parents, and there's nobody there supporting me. It's like, as a society, we're like, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about the death of your mother, father, brother, whoever. But then it's like, you're supposed to brush it off and get on with your life. And interestingly enough, I was at a palliative care conference, a few years ago, and listening to a talk about post-traumatic caregiver disorder. And it was like, that's me, because after my mom, my dad passed away in 2005, my mother passed away in 2016, and I was not doing well, but I couldn't put a finger to it. I couldn't like pinpoint exactly what was happening, and it was trauma. And I realized I was suffering from post-traumatic grief, but like, why is that? Why is there no support for grieving families?
I mean, it's a really important question. You know, I will say that in the United States, where I'm from, and from where I moved a couple of years ago, you know, a year and a half ago to come here, hospice care is institutionalized in such a way that, you know, a person becomes eligible for hospice at six, you know, with a prognosis of 6 months or less, let's say. That some physician is willing to say that this person may have 6 months or less based on their diagnosis and functional indicators, but hospice providers are required by law to provide up to a year of bereavement support for family members. So it's kind of baked into now. There's all sorts of problems with hospice in the United States, not least of which is the sort of rise of for-profit hospice, and the way in which they sort of have tried to limit those services or do them in ways that only pay lip service to the idea. But I think it recognizes that, you know, that bereavement is an important part of the experience of end of life for those who are left behind. And in fact, if you know, I described this model of sort of curative care, then palliative care, versus a model that sort of where palliative care is more and more integrated over time. And in fact, the tail end of that is a triangle that represents bereavement and our support of families. I think part of the challenge of being left alone after the death of someone important to us is, you know, not being certain that what you're feeling is normal or okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we've learned from people who study bereavement and who provide bereavement care is that, one, it's incredibly normal. There's a huge range of normal things that happen when you are grieving the loss of someone that you love. And just being able to hear that is an incredibly important intervention, to be able to connect with others who have had similar experiences, to be able to recognize, for instance, when someone is having what we think of as complicated grief, when it interferes so much with their function that they're not able to sort of get on in the world and move forward through their grief. It's never about grief is never about dismissing this person from your life. It's about integrating their absence in a way over time that allows you to, you know, draw meaning from that experience and to be okay. Because I think at the end of the day, we're all just trying to like make it through life in ways that feel good to us, you know, that we feel like we're doing the best we can in situations that feel really difficult. And I think bereavement support is incredibly important. We have to find ways to institutionalize that, not just for people with cancer, for whom I think there's probably better bereavement resources, but also for people who lose loved ones in different ways.
So what improvements can be made in the field of palliative care, whether that be on a provincial level, on a national level, or an international level? What improvements need to be made?
I think the biggest improvement is one of access. And I think that that comes down in my mind to a few different things. First is, and I wrote about this recently, you know, first is sort of a reconceptualization of how we think about palliative care. If we think about palliative care as something that is only for people at the end of life, we will invariably miss people and not give them the opportunity to benefit from what is really the best possible care. And what I say is that if you have a serious illness in which your well-being or that of your caregivers is threatened by a life-limiting illness, and you're not getting palliative care, you're really not getting access to the best possible care. And I think we need people to stand up and demand that of our policymakers and to say, we have an aging society with increased rates of dementia, increased rates of other serious illnesses. And if we don't have access to palliative care, then which saves the healthcare system money as well, in addition to improving the quality of care, then we're really missing something important. So I think that's you know, how we conceptualize palliative care is really important. How we access palliative care, we need more palliative care in the community to support people in being at home as long as possible, including up to death, if that's what they desire. And we need better resources in the hospitals to ensure that people who are very sick and are suffering have access to the highest quality care. I think those are sort of the three sort of things that I see as being the most important thing for us to focus on in palliative care.
Well, it's the same thing like in the field that I'm working in dementia, you know, people don't understand the illness, but equally they don't understand how to access the resources in the community that could help them, right? Like they just don't know whether that be not-for-profit resources or for-profit resources. People just don't know how to access these resources that are available to them.
I think that's right. And, you know, my vision for this healthcare system is that rather than being in a place where we are constantly reacting to the needs of people with serious illness, you know, be it from advanced cancer or advanced heart disease or dementia, is that we have a proactive system. We take a proactive approach to caring for people. And that involves recognizing who they are, first and foremost. We need data infrastructures that allow us at a population level to see who is out there who may need our services, and to proactively ensure that they have them, not wait for some, you know, enlightened physician to say, hey, this person's really sick, like maybe I should refer them to palliative care, maybe if I can get them to do that. Rather, we need to say, okay, these are the people in our healthcare system that are seriously ill. We need to ensure in a proactive sense that they are getting everything that they need that supports their dignity and well-being, not waiting around for the lucky ones to be referred to palliative care and the unlucky ones to suffer until they're admitted to the hospital, you know, dying, which is unfortunately kind of the reality for many.
So my last question is, for those people watching who are from Quebec, what resources are offered to palliative care services are offered for people who want to spend their final days at home? Yeah. Where should people turn to?
Unfortunately, it is highly dependent on where you live. And I think that this variability is something that should be attended to by our policymakers. And I think that if people find themselves in a region that doesn't offer good home services for palliative care, they need to stand up and demand that from their local policymakers. I will call out that the CLSC in Verdun provides what I think of as some of the most sophisticated home-based palliative and end-of-life care probably anywhere in the world. I mean, they're doing something incredibly extraordinary in terms of providing access and services to people at home and that allow them to stay at home. It's extraordinary. There are other CLSCs throughout the province where there are no palliative care clinicians and where access is incredibly scant. And so, you know, this postcode lottery is something that we should be dealing with. You know, we have the opportunity having a relatively centralized healthcare system to address this and to ensure that innovations in one place sort of spread to others. And we need resources to do that. So,
So what does this outstanding palliative care service look like? Like what should people expect?
Yeah, well, they have people who are trained to provide palliative care. They have nursing infrastructure that allows them to be to triage people where necessary and to make sure that they are getting the best possible care at home through an interdisciplinary approach that includes social workers, spiritual care providers, nurses, physicians. And I think it takes, it takes leadership. And they happen to have a fantastic leader, a fantastic set of leaders in that institution that are committed to this idea of providing home-based palliative care. I think part of the solution is education. If we're starting with people in medical school and helping them recognize that this is important, they're going to grow up to be leaders who want to do this in the places where they work.
Well, Dr. Sanders, you are certainly a great choice to lead the palliative care program at McGill. I mean, really, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today and for this very thoughtful conversation.
Thank you so much for the time and for your efforts. And I think this is such an important area of work for us. And so I'm hoping we get a chance to speak again.
Well, thank you. This webcast is an initiative of the McGill Dementia Education Program, which is funded by private donations. If you would like to make a contribution to our program, please visit us at mcgill.ca/dementia. And if you would like to join our mailing list to be notified about upcoming episodes of McGill Cares, as well as other very important programs and resources that we offer, including virtual support for caregivers, please email us at dementia@mcgill.ca. Thank you for watching.